Hello, everybody. This is the NBC Newsroom in New York, bringing you the early morning news of the war from the three major news centers of Europe, London, Bern, Switzerland, and Moscow. For our first report by one of NBC's foreign correspondents, we take you to the capital of the British Isles. Go ahead, London.
This is John McVane in London. The German prisoners are still in the hospital ship at New Haven today, but it's officially said to be probable that the vessels will leave on the midnight tide tonight. They'll move outside the harbor and anchor until dawn, then proceed to the French port of Dieppe, where the British wounded prisoners are waiting. The German women who are being repatriated won't leave England until Wednesday, when the hospital ships cross the channel for the second batch of British prisoners. The length of time required to carry out the exchange will probably depend on whether tide conditions at Dieppe permit a quick landing of the German prisoners and the quick embarkation and return of the British prisoners. No bombs fell on Britain last night, and there is no report of RAF activity. There's no confirmation in London of the Ankara report that the British and Russian governments have asked Afghanistan to expel German nationals who are in the country. Military quarters here say the Germans are keeping up pressure all along the Russian front except in the Leningrad region. These quarters say that the Germans are making two big new attacks, both aimed at Moscow. One is a pincer movement from Smolensk toward Moscow, and the second is a direct smash at the capital from the northwest. The Germans seem to have made some progress. The other day, I happened to be passing through Oxford. I stopped off for an hour and visited one of the colleges I'd known in peacetime. The ancient gray stone buildings surround a quadrangle that used to be a beautiful square of green lawn. In the center of the lawn now is what looks like a miniature swimming pool. That's our new water tank to use in case of bomb fires, the college porter explained. We like it so well, we're going to leave it there after the war. Then he shook his head and said, "But I can see that after some of the gentlemen have their parties, more than one is going to feel like using it for a moonlight swim." He explained that undergraduates now usually stay at the university for only a year before they join the army. Undergraduates of three colleges, he said, have been crammed all together in the one college. He said he thought English college boys today are perhaps somewhat more serious than before the war. And he spoke regretfully of the escapades and athletic feats of boys who had been at the college before the war. Most of the boys and men he spoke of are in one or other of the British fighting forces. Some remembered because of the way they pulled an oar on the crew, or for their jokes in the dining hall, or for their careless ease with which they won high scholastic marks, have died in France or Greece or Libya. Some went out when their planes flamed down through the night sky over Germany. Others when they hurtled their fighters against the huge German formations glistening in the English sunlight last fall. But the porter remembered them for little things, a joke, or a flashing oar in the sluggish winding river. The beauty spot of the college used to be the garden, shaded by a great tree. Boys and faculty members sometimes used to play bowls in the green turf, rolled and clipped for hundreds of years. The porter took me into the garden. The turf has been dug up and air raid trenches wind in ugly curves across what used to be the lawn. "The war do make changes, don't it?" the porter said as he looked over the garden. Then he brightened and said, "But in a few days, we'll have new gentlemen in college. Not that they'll be like the old ones, but it's nice to have them here." The Archbishop of Canterbury, speaking at the annual diocesan conference at Canterbury today, said, "We cannot condone the cruelties which marked and stained the Russian Revolution. But there are signs that there has been in recent years a change of spirit in the ruling powers. A fuller place has been given to the freedom of individuals, and there has been a fuller toleration of religion." This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
We take you now to Bern, Switzerland.
Hello, NBC. This is Charles Lanius in Bern. Military developments on the Eastern Front hold the interest of most Europe today. This interest hit a new high after Hitler's statement on Friday that new and important operations were underway and his intimation that they would have far-reaching results. Nevertheless, from this international observation post, the true situation in the East remains obscure. That is to say, that although there's much speculation and reams of conflicting reports, there's no clear picture here of which way the fight is going. We know that the Germans have launched new offensives in the south and north, but it's hard to tell from here just how successful the attacks are turning out. The German high command claims that they are successful, and the Russians say there aren't. Late reports coming out of the capital of the Third Reich shed little light on the subject. Germans are being told that the offensive operations are proceeding favorably, that strategic Russian positions have been taken, and that their soldiers are mopping up in the south. On the other hand, the Russians claim victories at a number of points. In the southern sector, the Reds report a series of heavy counterattacks, which have been successful, and that in 3 days their troops have retaken 30 districts held by the Germans and Romanians. At another point in the south, the exact location isn't given, the Soviets claim to advance 32 kilometers in 36 hours in spite of all efforts of the Germans to stop them. Moscow dispatches say that the Red advance is continuing in the face of what is described as massive air attacks by the Luftwaffe. A supplement to the latest Russian communique tells of their own activities. Russian flyers are credited with bringing down 30 German planes in air battles and to destroy a number of others on the ground when one of their Soviet pilots bombed a German airfield holding 34 machines. The Russians assert that at various points on the front, their airmen have accounted for 41 German tanks, 90 other vehicles, and 4 gasoline carriers. The Germans come right back, claiming the capture of 12,000 prisoners in the Crimea district, 34 Russian tanks, and 179 pieces of artillery. And that's the way it goes, claims and counterclaims. But through this maze of contradictions, one important thing emerges. There is no indication of any crack-up of the Soviet armies at any point along the front. They appear to have plenty of material, although the Germans have reported sensational captures. In fact, when the many messages reaching here have been thoroughly sifted, it would seem that at many points, the Russians have the edge over the invaders, or, as they like to say in Berlin, the German defense force. Meanwhile, more trouble is reported in the occupied countries, where the German authorities clamp down in their most efficient way, jailing and executing hundreds of persons who won't hold still as the Germans would like to have them do. In Prague, German firing squads have been busy, and according to information received here, the death toll is now well over 200, with more than 500 people in prison waiting for trials before German courts. The same kind of reports are coming in from all of the occupied countries. Of great interest here is the news of a naval battle between warships of unknown nationalities off the Brazilian coast. Only the barest reports have reached this country so far, but there's much speculation as to what this mysterious encounter is likely to lead to. No comment on the sea battle has yet come out of Berlin, but that's really not to be expected until the identity of the warship is established.
You have just heard from Bern, Switzerland. For our next report, we switch to the capital of the Soviet Union. Robert Magadoff will bring us the news from the Russian war fronts. Will you go ahead, Moscow?
This is Robert Magadoff speaking from Moscow. The Russians have admitted the loss of 5,316 planes since the outbreak of the Soviet-German war. This is, of course, a far cry from the 9,000 craft the Nazis have lost, according to the Russian estimates. But it certainly represents a serious loss to the Red Army's air arm. And yet, the Soviet Air Force remains a vital factor in the immense battle raging from the Arctic Ocean to the Black Sea. It has retained its aggressive spirit, and the Soviet flyers are as ever confident and fearless. As a matter of fact, the foreigners in Moscow speak of the Red Air Force as of one of the big surprises in this war, because, among other reasons, it so quickly recovered from the terrific shock of the initial surprise attack. The Russian aircraft industry, to which Joseph Stalin has devoted his untiring attention ever since 1926, is greatly responsible for the continued strength of the Red Air Force. The workers of the Soviet airplane factories, whom the military experts of the Harriman mission have praised so highly, along with the men working in other branches of Soviet war industry, have produced planes with all the speed and efficiency attached to a military task. At the same time, Soviet inventors and designers of planes have been constantly improving their dive bombers and fighters, of which the RAF boys now fighting the Germans and Russia have spoken of as most effective and up-to-date weapons. The fortunate part of it all is that but a small fraction of Russia's aircraft industry is located in regions now occupied by the Nazis, and it goes on turning out more and better planes daily. The craft arriving from the United States and Great Britain undoubtedly do come in very handy, but it does the Russians good to know that most of the planes fighting the Reichswehr and the Luftwaffe in the Soviet Union are Russian-made. There is every indication that the situation is even better as far as pilots are concerned. Ever the darlings of the nation, their number has kept steadily increasing from year to year, with flying academies absorbing the country's ablest and most daring youths and giving them excellent training. Fearless to a point of recklessness, they have originated and developed a new form of fighting in the air, ramming. The art of ramming consists of knocking off a vital piece of the opponent's craft in mid-air, preferably a bomber's tail, by hitting it with a whirling propeller. A prudent flyer, of course, would see to it that the rear gunner on the bomber is lying with a bullet in his head before attempting to ram the enemy plane. Ramming was first resorted to during the World War by the Russian ace Captain Nesterov. In 1915, he rammed an Austrian plane and perished with the enemy. The Soviet flyers, however, insist that ramming is not a suicidal act, but one of skill and daring. Among the several dozen cases of ramming that have been reported, there is surprisingly little loss of life on the part of the Red Aces, most of whom, however, did lose their machines. But the Russians know a bargain when they see one and are ready to swap a fighter for a bomber any time. I now return you to the NBC in New York.
And that's the latest news of the war. For word on developments here at home, we turn now to Earl Godwin, speaking from the NBC newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks. The kindly elderly gentleman who died here last night was once looked on as a dangerous radical. I'm old enough to remember when Louis Brandeis was nominated to the Senate to be Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. Many old-time conservatives believed Brandeis would tear down the pillars of the Republic, but they're still standing, and the Supreme Court today leads the nation's capital and the nation in mourning for the retired Associate Justice who passed on yesterday, 85 years old, while retired Chief Justice Hughes says and leads his lawyer friends and the world at large in saying that Brandeis left a permanent impression upon American jurisprudence. We've all assumed that the president would recommend that Congress amend the neutrality law and thus permit the arming of American merchant ships or something like that. He will meet with a group of congressional leaders of both parties tomorrow, and if he carries out his intention, he will decide and announce tomorrow. But over the weekend, there arises the intention also of several senators who disagree with the president. They are reported to be drumming up strength to oppose arming of merchant ships or tampering with the neutrality law at all, and at least one administration supporter tells reporters that he will tell the president not to stir up the neutrality amendment subject now. There is no indication the president will leave his charted course or take this advice. He seems to be headed straight for requesting an amendment or modification of the Neutrality Act. He seems to indicate arming merchant vessels or some other application of the doctrine of free seas for free American ships. Meantime, one of the president's friends, former associate oil magnate James A. Moffat, wires to friends in Washington that the I.C. White, that tank steamer torpedoed in the South Atlantic last week, as he understands it, is one of the ships the British wanted to return to American duty, but which was kept in British or other non-American service by Petroleum Coordinator Ickes. Moffat charges this ship was carrying oil by a route 2,000 miles too long to Cape Town, Africa, where, he says, they have so much surplus oil, it is outrageous, to use his word, to talk about a shortage in this country. We're still in a whirl of excitement over the faraway issue of religious freedom in Russia, as we learn that more or less obscure paper, which is said to be on the inside in Russia, starts attacking Hitler's persecution of churches in Germany. And the doughty Reverend Edmund A. Walsh of Georgetown University comes out with a statement here that the Russian Levatsky statement on Russian freedom for religion is a fake. However, American officials here take the Russian attitude as an encouraging sign. And that's all from Washington at this time.
And that's the news up to this moment. This morning we heard from John McVane in London, Charles Lanius in Bern, Robert Magadoff in Moscow, and Earl Godwin from Washington. This is the National Broadcasting Company.